death that I thought I'd put away for good. After I finished the chowder, I ordered another beer. The lone television soundlessly showed an old episode of Cheers, one of the early ones with Coach and Diane. My phone buzzed in my pocket, and I assumed it was Gwen calling to say she was ready to leave. But it turned out to be Marty Kingship. "Hey," I said.
"Got a minute?"
"Sure," I said, and thought about stepping outside of the restaurant, but I was the only one at the bar, and the bartender was unpacking boxes of wine far from where I was seated.
"I looked into your guy, Cheney, for you. He was a piece of work, let me tell you."
"What does that mean?"
"I mean, if you're looking for who wanted him dead, you'd be better off making a list of who didn't want him dead. He most likely killed his wife."
"What do you mean, most likely?"
"There was a house fire, one that he managed to escape while she didn't. Cheney's brother-in-law, the brother of the wife, filed a complaint saying he was sure that Cheney had set it, trapping his wife in the bedroom. He told the investigating officers at the time that Margaret, his sister, Cheney's wife, was planning on leaving Norman and that Norman knew it. He'd been a serial adulterer and she had proof, so she was going to get at least half of the money, if not more."
"Were they rich?"
"They had some money, for sure. He owned 2 service stations, but he'd also been investigated for money laundering. It went nowhere, though."
"Who was he money laundering for?"
"Oh, some local drug outfit. He must have stepped out of line at some point because one of his service stations got held up and an employee got shot. Only no one thought it was a regular holdup. It was probably revenge. This was only about 6 months before his wife died. Like I said, there was a whole slew of people wanting to get rid of Norman Cheney. He was a bad apple."
"What happened to him after the house burned down?"
"He sold off his service stations and bought a house up in some minuscule town in New Hampshire, up near the ski resorts. But someone found him there and killed him. Maybe the brother-in-law?"
"Why do you say that?"
"I'm not saying it, but the cop I talked to is. He was beaten to death in his own house, and there'd been a struggle. Chances are this had nothing to do with drugs. If he'd been targeted by a dealer, then someone would have just gone up there and shot him. It was an amateur, which means it was probably the brother-in-law."
"But he was never arrested?"
"I guess he had an alibi."
"What was his name?"
"Nicholas Pruitt. He's an English professor at New Essex University."
"I know, right? Doesn't exactly sound like a murderer."
"Depends on the type of book you like to read."
Marty laughed.
"Exactly. Definitely a murderer in an Inspector Morse book. In real life, not so much."
"Thanks for doing this, Marty," I said.
"You kidding me? This was the most fun I've had since that shower I took yesterday. And this is just the start. I'll keep looking for you."
"Will you? That would be great," I said. Marty coughed, then said,
"I don't mean to pry, but you're not in any kind of trouble or anything?"
"No, it's just like I said. The FBI questioned me about this guy who I'd never heard about, told me he had a collection of used mystery novels, a lot with a bunch of bookmarks from old devils."
"You believed them about that?"
I lowered my voice and tried to sound calm.
"I don't know, Marty. Not really. Before she died, Claire was back into drugs. You know all about that. Maybe she knew Norman Cheney, and they think that I might have gone after him because he provided drugs to her or something. That's what I'm guessing. I should never have asked you to."
"No, no, no," Marty quickly said.
"Fuck them. I know you'd have nothing to do with that. But I had to ask."
"Honestly, I wouldn't have worried about it, but when I started to think it had something to do with Claire, I just couldn't stop turning it over in my mind again and again."
"I'll keep looking into this guy, but nothing about Claire has come up. It won't either, Mal. I'm sure of it."
"Thanks, Marty," I said. "What you got is great. I owe you a drink."
"Let's do it sometime soon. I'll do a little more snooping for you and deliver my report. How about Wednesday?"
"That works," I said, and we made it official. 6 o'clock at Jack Crow's. After I'd stopped talking on the phone, the bartender floated over to check on my beer. I asked for a pen instead, then wrote down the name Nicholas Pruitt on a bar napkin. My body was buzzing with excitement. Nicholas Pruitt seemed so right somehow. If Norman Chaney had killed Pruitt's sister, then he'd have a definite motive. And he was an English professor, which meant he'd most likely be familiar with strangers on a train. I felt like I had found him. I had found Charlie. I decided that when I got together for a drink with Marty, I'd need to tell him to stop looking into Chaney. He was a retired police detective. Asking him to look into an unsolved crime was a little like dangling a piece of meat in front of a starving dog. I needed to make sure he stopped looking. It wasn't yet 2 o'clock, but I didn't feel like sitting at the bar any longer. I went back outside and wandered up and down Rockland's main street, brick buildings filled with shuttered gift shops and a few open restaurants. I tightened the scarf around my neck and went and looked out toward the harbor, protected by a mile-long jetty that jutted out into the ocean. It had been so cold that chunks of milky ice floated in the seawater. Farther out, the water sparkled in the sunlight. I was standing there, the breeze off the ocean cutting right through the layers of my clothing, when my phone buzzed again. This time it was a text from Gwen, saying that she was back at the hotel, ready to leave. I told her I'd be there in half an hour and began the walk back. On the drive back to Boston, Gwen told me about her day spent wrangling with the local police department, who didn't seem to consider the death of Elaine Johnson a priority. Still, she'd managed to get a team of forensic investigators to go over the house, in particular focusing on the handcuffs and the 8 books in the bookcase downstairs. I asked her if I'd get a chance to look at the books, maybe see where they'd come from. "They bagged them as evidence, but I'll have the photographs sent to you. Would you know if they came from old devils?" "Maybe, if I looked at them. All the books that wind up on the shelf are given a price by me or by one of my employees in the upper right-hand corner of the first page. But some books never make the shelves. They get sold online directly, and unless I remember a specific copy of a specific book, then I'm not going to recognize them." "But if Charlie came into your store and bought the books, or some of them, then it would mean he's a customer." "Right," Gwen said. We had just crossed over from Maine into New Hampshire, and it had gotten dark. Gwen's face was periodically illuminated by passing cars. "I forgot to ask, were there any witnesses?"
"What do you mean?"
she said. "I mean, did you find a witness who saw someone or someone's car outside of Elaine Johnson's house around the time of the murder?"
"Oh, that. No, I questioned the neighbor across the street who reported that Elaine's mail hadn't been picked up, but she hadn't seen anything. She's old, and I doubt she could even see anyone on the street."
"So no luck there," I said.
"I'm not surprised. If there's one other connection between all these murders, besides your list, it's that there have been no witnesses. No clues at all, really. No mistakes.
There must have been something."
"There was a murder weapon left behind at the site of Jay Bradshaw's homicide."
"He was one of the ABC murders?"
"Yes, he was beaten to death in his garage. In some ways, his murder is a bit of an outlier. It was messy, for one. He fought back, and there was a lot of blood. His garage was full of tools, all of which could have been the murder weapon, but it turned out that the weapon that was used, at least initially, was a baseball bat."
"How do they know it didn't come from the garage, that it was brought there?"
"They don't know, not for a fact. But there was no other sports equipment at Bradshaw's house, and all the tools in his garage were carpentry tools. That's what he was, a carpenter, although he'd been charged 10 years earlier with attempted rape while putting up bookshelves for a divorced woman. Since then, he'd done very little work. He kept a sign up in front of his house at all times advertising used tools for sale, and according to his only friend, he spent most of the day in his garage. He would have been easy to target. The baseball bat was the only piece of evidence found that seemed as though it didn't belong in his garage.
Was it special?
What, the bat?
Yeah, was there something unusual about it? Was it from the 1950s or anything, signed by Mickey Mantle?
No, it was new, and it was a brand that sold at just about every sporting goods store. It didn't go anywhere. Also, it didn't actually deliver the killing blow.
Bradshaw was hit by the baseball bat, but he'd been killed with a sledgehammer, directly to his head. Sorry for the image. When Gwen pulled up in front of the bookstore, she said, "Here you go," then quickly added, "Oh, maybe you wanted to go to your home. I didn't even ask."
"This is fine," I said. "I should probably check in here anyway, and I only live a few blocks away."
"Thanks for coming. As soon as I get those photographs of the books, can I send them to you?"
"Sure," I said.
The store was open for another 15 minutes, and I could see Brandon behind the front desk, a book splayed open in front of him. I swung through the front door, and he looked up.
"Boss," he said.
"Hey, Brandon." He tilted the book he was reading so I could see the cover. It was The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith, who not so long ago had been revealed to actually be J.K. Rowling.
"Good,"
he said, and went back to reading.
"I'm just popping in. Anything happen while I was away?"
He told me how yesterday afternoon a woman in a fur coat came in and bought $200 worth of new hardcovers and arranged to have them shipped to her address in Malibu. And he told me that he thought he'd finally fixed the faucet in the employee bathroom that was always leaking.
"Thanks," I said.
I heard Nero's plaintive meow and bent down to greet him.
"He misses you, I think, when you're not here," Brandon said.
And something about those words caused me to have one of those periodic waves of deep sadness that suddenly infect me from time to time. I stood suddenly, and the light swam in front of my eyes. I was hungry, I realized. It was late, and I hadn't eaten since lunch in Rockland. I walked home and got my car, then drove over the river to Somerville, the town I'd lived in with Claire. I sat at the bar at R.F. O'Sullivan's, a place I hadn't been for years, drinking Guinness and eating one of their softball-size burgers. Afterward, I drove to the Somerville Public Library, pleased to see it was still open. I went to the second floor and found a computer with an open internet browser, punched in the name that Marty had given me earlier, Nicholas Pruitt. Not only was he an English professor at New Essex University, he had published a book of short stories called Little Fish. There were two pictures of him I could find online, an author photograph plus a candid from a faculty cocktail party. He was about what you'd expect a college English professor to look like, tall and stoop-shouldered, with a slight paunch and hair that stuck up at the front as though he constantly ran his fingers through it. His hair was a brownish-black, but his closely trimmed beard was salted with gray. In his author photograph, he was turned to a three-quarters profile and was staring toward the camera with an expression that seemed to be asking for validation. "Take me seriously," it said. "I just might be a genius." Maybe I'm being harsh, but that was what I saw. I've always been suspicious of literary writers with their attempts at immortality. That is why I much prefer thriller writers and poets. I like the writers who know they are fighting a losing battle. While there was plenty of online information about Nicholas Pruitt, who went by Nick, it seemed, there was very little information about his personal life. If he was married or had kids, I couldn't find any confirmation of that fact. The most telling thing I read about him was on a site that enabled students to anonymously grade their professors. The bulk of his reviews pointed to a decent professor who was sometimes a hard grader, but one user wrote, "To be honest, Professor Pruitt gave me the creeps. He was far too into Lady Macbeth, to be honest. I don't know why he insisted on acting out all her parts." It wasn't much, but it was something. I had already constructed an entire fantasy of what might have turned Nicholas Pruitt into Charlie.
The way I imagined it was that Pruitt's sister Margaret marries Norman Cheney, who turns out to be not only a creep, but a criminal, and a man who murders Pruitt's sister and gets away with it. Pruitt decides to kill Norman Cheney, but knows that if he does it, he will be the prime suspect. So, thinking he might be able to hire someone to kill Cheney, he goes on to Duckburg and finds my message about strangers on a train. He's an English professor and knows that book well. He knows what I'm suggesting, and we exchange names and addresses. He kills Eric Atwell. It goes well, not just because he gets away with it, but because he actually enjoys it. It gives him the power he has always craved. When Norman Cheney dies, while Pruitt is away somewhere establishing an alibi, he feels further empowered. Killing feels good. He decides he has to find out who he swapped with, who murdered Cheney for him. It wouldn't have been hard. A little snooping and he'd discover that Eric Atwell had been questioned by police in regard to a motor vehicle accident that took the life of Malcolm Kershaw. Not only that, but Malcolm Kershaw works at a mystery bookstore. He'd even once posted a list of 8 perfect murders in fiction. It included strangers on a train. Years go by, and Pruitt can't forget how alive he felt when he'd taken a life. Every semester when he teaches Macbeth, he feels the bloodlust in him grow a little more. He decides that he needs to do it again, commit murder. Inspired by the list of 8 perfect murders, he begins to look for victims. Maybe he'll even make it obvious. That way Malcolm Kershaw and he might finally meet. It made perfect sense, and I was filled with excitement, mixed with dread. I needed to meet Nick Pruitt and see how he'd react. But first, I wanted to read his book of short stories. I logged on to the Minuteman Library Network to see where the book was available, hoping it was here at Somerville, but it wasn't. There was, however, a copy listed as available at Newton Public Library. They weren't open now, but would be the following morning at 10. Chapter 17. I began rereading The Secret History the next morning at the store. I was tired of waiting. Waiting for Newton Public Library to open so I could go get a copy of Nicholas Pruitt's Little Fish. Waiting to hear from Gwen. Waiting for more information from Marty Kingship on the murder of Norman Cheney. I read the prologue in the first chapter and was instantly swept up in the narrator's obsession with the small coterie of classics students at the fictional College of Hampton. Like Richard Poppin, I have always been fascinated by intimate groups, by close-knit families, by sibling bonds. But unlike Richard, I never found a group to join, the closest being my fellow antiquarian booksellers. But more often than not, when we gather, I feel like an imposter in their midst. The temperature had risen that day, and snow was melting all over the city. Puddles were forming, and gutters were overflowing, and the pedestrians were out in droves. It was a busy morning, a steady stream of browsers dripping on the hardwood floor. At just before noon, I told Emily that I was going home for lunch, and could she cover the register? I'd parked out front at a meter, so I got into my car and took Storrow Drive to Newton, then cut through some back roads to get to the main library, an enormous brick structure close to Commonwealth Avenue. I found Little Fish on the library's 2nd floor and took the slim paperback volume to a cushy leather chair in a corner of the library near the poetry section. I quickly perused the list of story titles on the contents page, looking, I suppose, for something that might indicate a crime story, something with a murder in it, or some malice. But most of the titles felt either generic or self-consciously literary. The Garden Party. What Was Left After It Happened. Hence the Pyramids. A Platonic Kiss. Nothing jumped out, so I decided to read the title story, Little Fish. I was only halfway through it when I realized that it was not particularly helpful. In the story, a college senior at a thinly disguised Bowdoin College remembers how his father took him on a fishing trip in upstate New York when he was 10. The lessons of the trip, throwing the little fish back being the most obvious one, reverberate with the narrator's current relationship. The story was not impressive. At least not to me, and I gave up on it halfway through. Then I scanned the remaining stories in the collection, not finding much. Honestly, I don't know exactly what I was looking for, but maybe just one story that pointed toward an unhealthy attitude toward revenge or justice. I flipped to the front of the book to see if there was a dedication, and there was. A simple one. To Jillian. I got up and wandered until I found an unmanned computer, then opened a browser window and put in Jillian, then New Essex University. The name that most frequently came up was Jillian Nguyen, who had been an English professor at New Essex before getting a job at Emerson College here in Boston. I memorized her name, deciding I'd contact her, but not until I found out some more about Nick Pruitt. Then I flipped to the back of the book and saw that there was an author photograph, different from the one I'd seen online. It was also a three-quarters profile. Clearly, Pruitt thought he had a good side. But in this one, he was wearing a hat, a felt fedora, the type of hat that detectives wore in old movies. As soon as I saw it, I thought of the man at the end of my street I'd seen on Saturday night, the man I thought was following me. He was wearing a hat similar to this one. Before leaving, I riffled through the pages of the book to see if it had one of those security tags. I didn't find one, and I considered going to the bathroom and hiding the book under my shirt. But the library was busy, people coming and going, and I simply decided to walk out with the paperback in my hand as though I'd already checked it out. I didn't think they'd miss it. And it seemed prudent that there was no record on my library card of me having borrowed a Nicholas Pruitt book. I walked through the sensors, no alarms sounded, and out into the warm afternoon. Back at the store, I emailed Gwen to find out if she'd gotten photographs yet of the books we'd seen in Elaine Johnson's house. Then I tried to read some more of the secret history, but couldn't concentrate. I ended up pacing through the store, trying to figure out what to do next, straightening shelves. After Brandon came in for his afternoon shift, I decided that I could probably go home. It was Tuesday, and quiet, and I was waiting to speak with Gwen, something that I'd rather not do in a place where people might hear me. I put the secret history in my messenger bag and asked Brandon if he minded being alone. He frowned and said,
"Nah, I'm good."
"Okay, then. Call me if anything comes up."
"Will do."
The temperature had dipped, so that all the melted snow had now transformed into ice, the sidewalks littered with dirt and salt. The afternoon was bright, and I was reminded that the days were already getting longer, even though winter would continue unabated for at least 2 more months. I didn't mind it, personally, but I could read the faces of the passers-by on my walk home. Pale and grim, resigned to this gray city and to the long, wet slog toward springtime. Out of habit, I peered through the plate glass windows of the Beacon Hill Hotel and into their snug bar, always wondering if my co-owner Brian would be in residence. He was in today, wearing one of his familiar Harris tweed jackets, anchoring the far side of the oval bar. I hesitated on the street, deciding whether I should join him, when I saw his large, shaggy head lift up and notice me through the glass. "Hey, Brian," I said, sliding onto the stool next to him, curious about the half-filled martini on the bar with the lipstick imprint on its rim.
"Tess is here," he said,
and just as he said it, I turned to see Tess Murray, his wife for the past 10 years, returning, I assumed, from the bathroom, fresh lipstick on her lips. "Oh, sorry, Tess," I said, stepping back to let her retake her seat.
"No, sit there. We're always thrilled to have a buffer between us, aren't we, Bri?"
She slid her martini over, and I sat down between them. I saw Tess far less than I saw Brian, and it was very unusual that she was out for a drink with him, especially early on a Tuesday afternoon. She was his second wife and had to be at least 20 years younger than he was. Everyone said that she'd been his publicist and that was how they met, but I knew that it wasn't true. She was a publicist, or had been, back when she worked full-time, but not for him. They'd met the only year he'd attended BoucherCon, the annual crime writers' conference. He didn't usually go, but they'd made him guest of honor, and that had forced his hand. Brian had told me many times that the only way their marriage worked was that Tess spent 6 months at their house on Longboat Key without him, and that he spent the other 6 months at their cabin in Down East Maine without her. They occasionally ran into each other in Boston. "How are you not in Florida right now, Tess?" I said.
"You didn't hear? Brian, show him your arm."
I turned, and Brian lifted his left arm, ensconced in a device that looked vaguely bionic. "Oh, no."
"It's not a big deal," he said. "I fell a week ago, stepping down from this very same bar stool. Didn't feel a thing except the remainder of my pride leaving my body. But apparently it's broken in two places, and you'd be surprised how hard it is to be a one-handed drunk at my age."
"Are you writing right now?"
"Turned in the new one just before Christmas, but I've got copy edits to do and cans of soup to open up, so Tess is making the sacrifice."
"I tried to talk him into coming down to Florida, but you know what that's like," Tess said. "We've been meaning to call you, Mal, ask you for a drink, and now here you are."
"He knows where to find me," Brian said,
then finished his drink, almost always a scotch and soda in a lowball glass with two cubes of ice. I ordered a left-hand stout and managed to talk Brian and Tess into letting me buy them each a drink, another scotch for Brian and a Grey Goose martini for Tess.
"How's business?" Tess said. "I'd ask Brian, but he never knows."
"It's the same," I said. "Not bad at all."
"What's selling?"
Even though she no longer worked as a publicist, last I heard, she owned a boutique jewelry store in Florida. She still loved to hear about the business. I liked Tess and had defended her on a number of occasions to other people in the industry, some who saw her as a gold digger who didn't even have the decency to spend much time with her older, rich husband. But she was always nice to me, and Brian had told me several times how much he valued their marriage, how she understood how important solitude was to him, how she loved him in her own way. I stayed for two beers, aware the whole time that my phone might ring or buzz with a message from Gwen. When they ordered dinner, I said that I'd leave, that I had food at home to cook, which was a lie, but Brian was starting to slur a little, and I wanted to get out before the monologues started. Before I left, I said, "Did you hear about Elaine Johnson?"
"Who?"
Brian said. "Elaine Johnson. She used to come into the store every day before she moved to Maine. Coke bottle glasses?"
"Sure,"
Brian said, and I was surprised that Tess, to my right, was nodding along as well. "She died of a heart attack."
"How'd you hear about that?"
I almost told him. Told the two of them, I guess, about Agent Mulvey and the list, but stopped myself for some reason. "Another customer told me," I lied. "Just thought you might be interested."
"Good riddance to her," Tess said,
and I turned toward her, surprised. "You knew her?" I said.
"Sure. She cornered me at one of Brian's readings to tell me what a hack he was. I told her I was his wife, and she burst out laughing, asking me if I read his books before I married him. I'll never forget it."
Brian was smiling.
"She was all right, actually. I remember her now. Told me once her favorite writer was James Crumley, so I figured she couldn't be all bad. She moved to Rockland in Maine, didn't she?"
"How'd you know that?"
"Emily, probably, last time I did a shift at Old Devil's. She keeps track of all the problem customers for me."
"Huh," I said, slightly annoyed that Brian, who saw Emily probably every 3 months, seemed to have a better relationship with her than I did. Tess walked me out. I wondered why, but when we got to the sidewalk, she said, "This stupid accident has changed him completely. He's terrified of everything now. Walking, getting out of bed, doing anything. I can stay with him, but not forever. I've got the store in Florida, and I just can't deal with him all the time, and I'm not sure he can deal with me."
"Maybe you should get some help."
"Exactly. That's what I've told him 100 times, but he doesn't want to hear it. Look, if we have you over for dinner some night, will you bring it up for me? Maybe if he hears it from someone else?"
"Sure," I said.
"Thanks, Mal. I appreciate it. Don't get me wrong, I'd do absolutely anything for Brian, and he'd do absolutely anything for me. But helping him get out of a bathtub was not part of the deal."
She pushed a strand of her long, dark hair behind one of her ears, then leaned in and kissed me on the lips before pulling me in for a hug. She'd done this before, even in front of Brian, who never seemed to mind. Tess shivered in my arms as we hugged.
"Oh, how do you stand this weather?"
she said as she released me. Walking home, I could smell her on my skin, a lemony perfume and the smell of olives from her martini. I ate cereal for dinner that night, read some more of The Secret History, and waited for Gwen to get in touch. I sent her one more text before going to sleep, saying that I hoped everything was all right. And it was her face I thought of as I lay in bed, not my wife's. Chapter 18. The door buzzer went off at just past 8 the following morning. I was up already and dressed, starting to brew some coffee. I pressed the intercom and a male voice came over, saying that his name was Agent Barry and asking if he could come up. In the interval it took for the 2 sets of footsteps to loudly climb the stairs, I had enough time to think about what to do when the questions came. I made several quick assumptions. They were here either to arrest me, or to question me about the death of Eric Atwell or Norman Chaney, or both. The reason Gwen hadn't returned my messages the day before was because I had become a suspect in a homicide. I went to my door and opened it. Agent Barry was tall and stoop-shouldered, dressed in a pinstripe suit. He showed his FBI identification, reintroduced himself, and said he had come up from the New Haven office and had a few questions. Behind him stood a much shorter woman, also in a suit. He introduced her as Agent Perez from the Boston office. I invited them both in, said that I was about to make coffee, and asked if they wanted some. Agent Barry said he wouldn't mind. Agent Perez, who was now looking out the window, said nothing. I started the coffee and felt surprisingly calm. All the adrenaline that had flooded through me after the buzzer sounded had dissipated with their arrival. I was light, almost spacey, as I walked the short distance to the chair and directed them to the sofa. Agent Barry adjusted his suit pants above the knees before sitting down. He had enormous hands, spotted with age, and a large, elongated head with heavy jowls. He cleared his throat and said,
"I was hoping you'd be able to shed some light on your relationship with Gwen Mulvey."
"Okay," I said.
"Can you tell us when you first met her?"
"Sure," I said. "She called me at the bookstore, at Old Devil's, where I work, last Thursday, and asked if she could come in and ask some questions."
"Is she all right?" "What were the questions she wanted to ask you?" he said.
Agent Perez still hadn't spoken, but she had pulled out a small, spiral-bound notebook and had uncapped a pen. "She had questions about a list I'd made, a blog post from several years ago." Barry pulled out his own notebook and peered down at it.
"Called 8 Perfect Murders?
I could hear what sounded like disdain in his voice.
"That's right," I said. "And what were her questions related to?"
I was under the impression that they already knew all about the conversation Gwen and I had had, but decided to tell them anything they wanted to know. Well, anything that I'd already told Gwen. So I began, explaining how Agent Mulvey had noticed a connection between the list I'd written in 2004
and several recent crimes. I mentioned how at first I'd considered the connection to be dubious, probably coincidental, but how we'd found the 8 books from my list at Elaine Johnson's house in Rockland.
Did it strike you as odd that Agent Mulvey asked you to accompany her on official FBI business, to visit the scene of a possible crime?
This question came from Agent Perez, the first words I had heard her speak. She leaned forward as she spoke them, the buttons of her suit jacket straining a little as though she'd recently gained weight. She couldn't have been much older than 30, with short black hair and a round face dominated by large eyes and thick brows. "I didn't," I said. "I think she honestly believed that since I'd written the list, since I'd read all the books on it, that I was the expert. She thought I might be able to notice something in Elaine Johnson's house. Also, I knew her. I'd known Elaine Johnson."
"So, what did you find out from your visit to her house?"
"What I found out, what we found out, Agent Mulvey and myself, was confirmation that someone really is using my list to commit murders, and that quite possibly it has something to do with me."
"Quite possibly," Agent Barry said, his jowls quivering.
Elaine Johnson was someone I knew, someone who used to come into my bookstore all the time. It's clear that her death signifies my involvement. Not my immediate involvement, but the fact that whoever is doing this either knows me or wanted me to find out about this or is somehow framing me.
"You discussed all this with Agent Mulvey?"
"Yes, we talked about all the possibilities." Agent Barry looked down at his notebook.
"Just to confirm, you discussed the murders of Robin Callahan, J. Brad Shaw, and Ethan Bird?"
"Yes," I said.
"And you discussed the murder of Bill Manso?"
"The man killed near the train tracks?" "Yes, we did."
"What about Eric Atwell?" he said, looking up at me.
"We talked about Eric Atwell a little bit because of his relationship to me, but we didn't discuss him as a victim in this particular series of crimes."
"And what was his relationship to you?"
"Eric Atwell's?"
"Yes."
"It's clear that she wrote all this down," I said. "I don't know why you can't just speak with her or consult her notes."
"We just want to hear it from you," said Agent Perez.
I'd noticed that any time she spoke, Agent Barry would shift on my sofa uncomfortably, as though he had an itch he was too embarrassed to scratch. Eric Atwell had been involved with my wife at the time of her death. He'd gotten her hooked on drugs, and the night she died in a car accident, she'd been driving back from his house.
"And Eric Atwell was murdered, correct?"
"He was shot, yes. It was my understanding that the police thought it was a robbery, and it was pretty clear that Agent Mulvey didn't think it had anything to do with the perfect murders list."
"Okay, one more," Agent Barry said. "Did you two discuss the death of Stephen Clifton?"
I paused, stunned for a moment. Stephen Clifton was the name of the science teacher who had molested Claire Mallory back when she was in middle school. I had never heard Gwen mention him. I shook my head and said, "No, I don't know that name."
"No?
It's not familiar," I said.
"Okay,"
Agent Barry said, and flipped a page in his notebook. He didn't seem concerned that I hadn't heard of Stephen Clifton. He asked,
"Did Agent Mulvey ever confide in you her suspicions about who might be responsible for these murders?"
"No," I said. That was why she had come to me. She was trying to find out if there was anyone in my life, any customers, any ex-employees, whom I might suspect.
"And was there anyone?"
"There wasn't," I said. "Isn't. At least, not that I could think of. Elaine Johnson was probably the oddest customer who used to come into the store, but she's obviously not guilty."
"You told Agent Mulvey that you currently have 2 employees working for you."
"That's right, Brandon Weeks and Emily Barsamian." The only other person who occasionally works in the store is my co-owner, Brian Murray. Both agents wrote in their notebook. Wind buffeted the window of my apartment. Is she okay? I asked, the words coming out spontaneously. Agent Barry looked up, his lower lip between his teeth. He said, Agent Mulvey has been suspended from the agency. I need to let you know that she has been informed that she can no longer make any contact with you. Oh, I said. Why? The agents glanced at each other, then Agent Perez said,
I'm afraid we can't talk about that. And any information you can provide from here on in should be provided only to me or to Agent Barry.
I nodded. They looked at each other again, and Perez said, Would you be willing to come back with me to the office and give a full statement? I followed Agent Perez to Chelsea in her car, and she was the one who questioned me in a plush, small room with a recording device, plus two cameras mounted high in the ceiling. We started at the beginning, the origin of the list, the books I'd chosen, Gwen Mulvey, and the questions that she'd asked. She wanted to know everything about our interaction, all the details we'd talked about. Agent Perez didn't ask about Eric Atwell again, or about Stephen Clifton, and I was relieved, although it had occurred to me that she was maybe holding some cards close to her chest. The interview took the entire morning, and I felt strangely guilty, as though I were cheating on Gwen Mulvey with this new agent, telling her everything that we had talked about. I kept wondering why she'd been suspended from the agency and what it had to do with my list and what was happening. Toward the end of the interview, I did ask Agent Perez one last time if she could tell me anything more about Agent Mulvey.
There are procedures that we have to follow in the course of an investigation, and Agent Mulvey didn't comply with those procedures. That's all I can really say.
Okay, I said.
Before you go, I should ask you if you feel the need for police protection for yourself?
She twisted what looked like a wedding band.
No, I guess I don't, I said, pretending like I was thinking about it. But I will be careful.
One last thing before I let you go, she said. I know that you provided an alibi to Gwen Mulvey for the date of the death of Elaine Johnson, but I was hoping you could do the same, or attempt to do the same for the other murders.
I can try, I said. She sent me home with a list of exact dates for the murders of Robin Callahan, Jay Bradshaw, Ethan Bird, and Bill Manso. I went onto my computer to look at my calendar, but was suddenly exhausted, unable to deal with it at that moment. I stood up, was instantly lightheaded, and realized that the only thing I'd eaten all day had been a plastic-wrapped raspberry Danish during my morning interview. I went to my kitchen and made myself two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, ate them both with two large glasses of milk. It was 1:30. The good news was that I was getting a drink with Marty Kingship at Jack Crow's Tavern at 6 that evening. I knew he'd have more information for me on Norman Chaney's death, probably more information on Nicholas Pruitt. In the meantime, I needed to figure out what to do between now and that meeting at 6. It wasn't worth contacting Pruitt myself. Not yet, anyway. Then I remembered the dedication in his book of short stories. To Jillian. I got online and looked some more at Jillian Nguyen, the possible dedicatee. She'd been an adjunct professor at New Essex, primarily teaching survey courses for incoming freshmen. At Emerson College, where she was now, she was teaching some literature classes, but was also teaching poetry in the creative writing department. I Googled some of her poetry. As was often the case with contemporary poets, I barely understood what I was reading, although there was one poem published in a journal called Undivider, titled Sunday Afternoon at the Pem. The Pem was the Peabody Essex Museum located in Salem, Massachusetts, a town adjacent to New Essex. The poem itself was largely about an exhibit related to Vietnamese folk art, although there was a he in the poem, a companion of the speaker who only saw the negative space, the bent flesh. I wondered if the companion was Nicholas Pruitt, and if he was, then I doubted Pruitt and Gillian Gwynne were still together. Even I could decipher the line from the poem as being critical. There was a phone number listed for Professor Gwynne on the Emerson faculty page, and I called it, not really expecting her to pick up, but she did, after two rings.
Hello?
Is this Professor Gwynne? I asked, hoping I was pronouncing it correctly.
Uh-huh.
Hi, this is John Haley, I said, spontaneously using the name of the previous owner of Old Devils. I was wondering if I could speak with you about Nicholas Pruitt. There was a pause, and for a moment I thought she might have hung up the phone, but then she said,
How'd you get my name?
I'm afraid that I can't be overly specific about my reasons for wanting to speak with you, except to say that Mr. Pruitt is being considered for a prestigious job, and it's very important that we fully vet him. Even as I said the words, I knew they weren't entirely convincing.
Fully vet him for what?
Look, I'm right here in Boston, and time is of the essence. Is there any possible way that I could meet with you this afternoon? Either in your office, or maybe we could meet for coffee.
Did Nick list me as a reference? She said.
I believe he mentioned you, but you wouldn't be giving an official reference. Anything you told me about him would be in total confidence. She laughed a little.
I'd be very surprised if I were asked to give some kind of reference. Well, you've piqued my interest.
You'd be doing me a huge favor if you'd meet with me.
Okay, she said. I can meet you this afternoon if you don't mind coming to me.
Not at all, I said.
There's a coffee shop in Downtown Crossing, Ladder Cafe. Do you know it?
No, but I'll find it.
I have office hours until 3. Will 3:30 work?
Chapter 19. The section of Boston known as Downtown Crossing is on the other side of the Boston Common. It used to be anchored by the large department stores, notably Filene's and Macy's, although both those buildings are currently empty. What remains is a mishmash of sneaker stores and hot dog vendors, plus a few hip bars and restaurants, hoping that the city will successfully be able to rebrand the area as the Ladder District, something they'd been trying to do for a few years now. Clearly, the Ladder Cafe was on board with the rebranding. Sandwiched between a fabric shop and a sports bar, the Ladder was a narrow, high-ceilinged room with tattooed baristas and minimalist art on the walls. I got there early, procured a large cafe au lait, and sat with a view toward the front doors. I suspected that Gillian Gwynne, when she arrived, would have many questions about why I was asking her about her former boyfriend. I decided that I would tell her as little as possible, except that he was being considered as the editor for a forthcoming anthology from a major publisher, and that there'd been some questions about his personal life. If pressed, I'd tell her I was working for a private detective firm doing a background check. I was hoping she wouldn't ask me for my card. At exactly 3:30, a woman I recognized as Gillian came through the doors. She was small, enveloped in a puffy jacket with a hood. She must have caught me looking at her, because she immediately came over and I introduced myself.
I only have about 20 minutes, she said, and I wondered if she'd gotten more wary since our phone call.
I offered to buy her a coffee, and she asked for an herbal tea. I stood in line again and got her one. It was impossible for me not to think of Claire, who always used to get herbal tea at coffee shops, and how it used to drive me crazy to pay $3 or more for what amounted to a tea bag and some hot water. Back at the table, I said, "Thanks so much again for meeting with me. I know this must seem very strange, but I've been asked to do a background check, and it has to happen very quickly because the publishers want to make a decision right away." She perked up at the word publishers, which I knew she would.
Oh, she said. What's the...
I can't actually tell you the publishing house, but he's being considered as an editor for a big anthology, and apparently someone somewhere expressed concern about his personal life, that it might inhibit him from doing the work. Jillian was about to take a sip of her tea, but set the mug back down on its saucer.
You said that this conversation would be entirely confidential.
Oh, absolutely, I said. 100%. I'll never even file a written report.
I haven't seen or spoken to Nick for over 3 years, not since I left New Essex. Clearly, you already know I filed a restraining order against him. Otherwise, why would you be talking with me, right?
Right, I said, then added, how long were you involved with him?
She looked toward the ceiling. Less than a year. I mean, less than a year that we were actually involved. I knew him for a year before we started going out, and after I finally broke it off, I was still in New Essex for another 6 months or so.
And can you tell me what prompted you to file the restraining order?
She sighed. He never actually hurt me or threatened me with physical violence. But after we broke up, he called me all the time, showed up wherever I was going to be, and once, it was only the once, but it was what caused me to get the restraining order, he got very drunk and broke into my house.
Jeez, I said.
The thing is, I do think he's actually a decent man, but he's a drunk. Do you know... Is he still drinking? The last time I spoke with him, he told me he'd been sober for over a month.
I'll be sure to find out. So he was never actually violent with you?
No, definitely no. Just persistent, really. He considered me the love of his life.
He dedicated his book to you, I said.
Oh, God.
She covered her face as though she was embarrassed.
I know. And it was after we'd broken up. Look, I don't want to stop Nick from getting a job that he probably needs. I had a bad experience with him, but if he stopped drinking, then maybe he'll be a good fit. He's very well read.
So, from your time knowing him, you don't think he'd be capable of any kind of violence? You never felt as though he'd be vengeful after you broke up?
She looked a little confused at the question, and I wondered if I'd taken it too far.
She started to speak, stopped, then said,
I never saw a violent side of him, but he did. He was very interested in violence from a literary point of view. He was attracted to stories of revenge, but that was just professional interest, as far as I knew. He's a pretty typical English professor, really. Bookish.
I wanted to ask her if she knew anything about what had happened to his sister, or subsequently his sister's ex-husband, Norman Cheney, but I already felt like I was treading on thin ice. Jillian Nguyen was studying me the way someone studies a person they might have to describe at a later time. I know these questions sound odd, I said. Apparently, and this is just between you and me, someone came forward to the publishing house and accused Nicholas Pruitt of a violent act.
Oh, Jillian said, and took a sip from her tea.
The publishers did not believe the accusation or the accuser was trustworthy, but just to make sure.
Oh my God, you think it's me?
Jillian said, straightening up in her chair. Oh, no, no, I said, not at all. We have the accuser's name. We're just looking for any kind of corroboration.
Okay, she said, and put her mug down. Look, I do need to go. Besides, I don't really have anything else to add.
She stood, and I did as well. Thank you, you've been very helpful. It was clear that I'd lost her trust, but I decided to test my luck. Just one last thing. As far as you knew, did Nick Pruitt own a gun? She was sliding on her huge coat, and she shook her head.
I mean, no, she said. Besides the antique guns, but I don't even think those work.
The antique guns?
He collects guns, not to shoot, but old revolvers, anything that was in an old crime film. It's his hobby.
Our waitress put down our beers, a Stella for Marty and a Bellhaven for me. We were in a back booth at Jack Crow's Tavern that felt like its own tiny room, reminding me of the pews at the old South Church. We each sipped our beer. Good to see you, Marty, I said. I'd seen him fairly recently, but he looked older to me. His white crew cut was sparser than ever, the skin underneath speckled with dark spots. And the large knuckled fingers of his hands were bent in a way that suggested arthritis.
"I'd forgotten about this place," he said, leaning out from our booth to look at the busy bar. "Last time we came here, we got nachos that had Brussels sprouts on them."
"Really?" I said. "I don't remember that."
"I'll never forget it. Who puts Brussels sprouts on nachos?"
"Now I remember," I said. "Let's stick to beer tonight." We touched glasses. "You find out anything new?" I said. I'd been debating whether I should tell him I'd gotten my own information on Nick Pruitt, especially what I'd heard about the gun collection, but I hadn't decided yet.
"Found out a little bit," Marty said. "Don't know if it will help you, but he's no saint, Nick Pruitt."
"No?"
"He's been arrested twice, once for DUI and once for drunk and disorderly after, get this, a Christmas Eve service. He got caught trying to steal a box of those little white candles they hand out. Also, he's had two restraining orders filed against him. Hold on."
He reached into the pocket of his wool blazer and pulled out a spiral-bound notebook plus a pair of reading glasses.
"The first was Jody Blackberry. This was in Michigan when he was a graduate student. She said she caught him peering through her window and following her around campus. The other one was much more recent, just 3 years ago, filed by a Jillian, N-G-U-Y-E-N. I won't do her the indignity of trying to pronounce it. Kind of the same type of thing. Ex-girlfriend who claimed he wouldn't leave her alone. He'd broken into her house."
"So nothing violent on his record? Nothing gun-related?"
"Nope. But that fits, doesn't it? If Nick Pruitt was the one who wanted Cheney dead, then he'd get someone else to do it. He's not really a killer, even though he's clearly a peeper and a guy who can't hold his liquor. Besides, I looked into the alibi and it's rock solid."
"His alibi for when Norman Cheney was killed?"
"Yep."
Marty looked down at his notebook again.
"It was March of 2011. Nick Pruitt was in California at a family reunion. It checked out. But like I said, I don't think he'd be the type who would beat his own brother-in-law to death, but he very well might be the type to have someone do it for him. Or maybe he asked someone to just rough Norman Cheney up and it went too far. Either way, he got away with it. My guess is, if you really want to know, it would be possible to shake it out of him, get him to make some sort of confession. I know his type, and if you bent him a little, I think he'd give it up. I'm not suggesting, just saying."
"Got it," I said. "No, all I needed was the information. It's helpful, Marty, thanks."
"No, thank you. I actually felt useful this week. First time in what feels like forever. The FBI still questioning you about this Cheney homicide?"
I took a long sip of my beer, wondering once again how much to tell Marty.
"They haven't, no," I said. "Apparently it all had something to do with a list I made on the old devil's blog about 100 years ago.
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah. You ever go to our blog?" "I don't know what the fuck a blog even is," Marty said.
"I don't do it anymore, but when I started at Old Devils, it was an online place where I wrote little articles. Reviews of new books, lists of my favorite authors, that type of thing. I wrote a piece once about my 8 favorite perfect murders in books, and someone in the FBI saw a connection between my list and a couple of recent unsolved homicides. They were pretty thin connections, though, so I don't think they'll follow up."
"What else did they ask you about?" he said, clearly interested.
Death down in Connecticut, someone who was found near the tracks of a commuter train. And they asked me about that newscaster,
Robin Callahan, sure," he said, jumping in. "Her husband did it. I can't believe they haven't made an arrest yet."
"You know that?" I said.
"I don't know it, but yeah, she was the one who wrote the book about how adultery was good for marriages. I think I'm safe in saying they ought to take a hard look at the husband."
I laughed. "Yeah, so I think I overreacted."
"I don't know if you overreacted. It sounds like they overreacted.
They asked you about all these cases?
I could tell he was getting more and more interested, and I just didn't want to involve him. He reminded me of a dog with a bone, and if I told him all about the copycat murders, he'd start looking into it. Not to mention that I'd actually given him the name of Norman Chaney.
They just asked me if I had any relationship with them, with Norman Chaney or this guy down in Connecticut or Robin Callahan, and I said no. I asked you about Norman Chaney because for whatever reason they seemed more interested in that. Honestly, though, it was nothing. At least, I hope it was nothing. Your daughter still coming to visit?
What books did you put on that list? He asked, ignoring my question about Cindy.
I told him, pretending I was having a hard time